This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a nonprofit with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Change menus, change lives. Learn more at chefscollaborative.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Thank you. Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. I am joined by Josh Evans, one of the many authors of the On Eating Insects cookbook. Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thanks very much.
Before we get into the book, I want to get into a little bit of your history. You went to Yale.
That's correct, for my undergrad, yeah.
And you studied what over there?
I was a humanities major, technically, which was very satisfyingly broad. Most of the coursework I did was in literature and philosophy and extremely impractical things like that, which nonetheless I find that I use actually all the time.
How does it apply, or how did it get you to the Sustainable Food Club?
At Yale. Mm-hmm. So that was ended up being my student job for sort of three of the 4 years that I was there. One of the reasons I chose to go to Yale was because of the Sustainable Food Project, because in high school I was becoming more and more interested in food and cooking and food systems and how sort of I had a lot of interests, and I still do, and food was a way that I could try and integrate them and bring them together, because food seems to me to be something that demands sort of pulling together all of these diverse perspectives. Well, and so when I went to Yale, that was really like a sort of something I sought out, a community to try and get involved with.
What was one of the earlier revelations when you were still in high school about how food affected the world? Even if it's a broad realization, What is one of the things that you saw where it took you on this path to this is more than just what I eat every day?
Yeah, I think it started probably really young. I mean, I grew up on the west coast of Canada on a big island called Vancouver Island and right on the ocean. So I spent a lot of time. My father would fish a lot and he would take me out fishing. And from a young age, I can remember landing like salmon that were larger than me and watching him, hit them on the head once very, very concisely, but very deliberately to kill them, and watching them die. And, you know, other things like very sort of sensory experiences of like being cut by thorns of blackberries while picking them, and my father keeping vegetables in the garden. And at that time, I didn't think of it as anything special, but now I see that those sort of experiences were very formative, not just in terms of loving to eat and growing up with that sense of attunement to the world, but also how they sort of set the stage for discovering later on how these very immediate kinds of experiences were directly implicated in like these larger systemic questions about how we produce food and how we share it with each other or fail to share it with each other in equitable ways, etc.
And so what type of work did the Yale Sustainable Food Project do that helped impact these or help maintain these or bring education to the student body and larger world around it?
I think a big part of it was having a physical space, having land, having like, I mean, it's a small garden, really. It's less than an acre, but having a space where every week anyone in the Yale community or in the New Haven community could come and put their hands into the soil and grow things and learn by doing things. And especially in that academic environment where most of the time you spend reading and writing and thinking and discussing and existing in your head so much, which was also very satisfying. It became a really crucial part of my academic experience to have this regular time to be in my whole body and like use my hands and get dirty, literally, and learn about food and agriculture in that very immediate sort of way, in a very kind of basic way, starting with the physical acts of making things, and then building on that.
Did you introduce any new species or any new vegetables or any new plants to the garden in your time there that you're super proud of?
Me personally?
Yes, you personally.
I don't think so. I mean, the garden was, the farm was, did produce a lot for a plot less than an acre.
And where did it go?
And a lot of it went to the weekly farmer's market, and some of it would be used for special events on the farm, too. Even though it was quite small, there was a really big range of plants and varieties that we grew.
What do you miss?
What do I miss?
Like, is there a potato that you grew?
So they have a variety of tomato called the Sun Gold, which they've been growing since the beginning in like 2003, and their particular Sun Gold, I've tried them other places, but like something about the Yale Farm Sun Gold is like particularly excellent.
Do you still have the key to the lock and you'll sneak in there overnight?
That's the plan, yeah, whenever I can, you know.
Speaking as a philosophy major, did you ever read to any of the plants? And if so, who did you read to them?
Oh, what a great question. It really depended on the season, I think. I probably recited more to them.
What did you recite to them?
T.S. Eliot, especially in the fall. But I mean, as an undergraduate, so that's an obvious choice. But hopefully fine. You'll forgive me.
No, it's forgivable.
I think currently I'm reading Sebald's Rings of Saturn. Mm. So, and I'm going back up to New Haven on Monday. So I think now that you mention it, now that you draw it to my attention again, I think I might try and read that to whatever's growing. The asparagus had its first sprouts coming up yesterday. So I think the asparagus might like some Sebald.
Just an early spring reading.
Yeah.
And from there, you made it over to the Nordic Food Lab.
Correct.
Which was started by Renee, founder of Noma.
Yeah.
Can you talk about the food lab for those who aren't known? Started in 2008.
Yeah, sure. So Nordic Food Lab is a nonprofit that was set up by Renee and Klaus Meyer, one of the other founder of Noma, as a space where chefs and also different academic researchers and food producers could come together to sort of together identify questions that would allow them to explore the edible potential of the Nordic region. And the focus was always really on taste and sort of mapping out the diversity of tastes that were available and figuring out how to use them in the kitchen. And from the beginning, the idea was that it would be about creating this knowledge and then sharing it in a very open way across these different sort of industries and cultures.
And it has a commons law, which is pretty interesting, right on the website that like pretty much everything is open and free. And it's very interesting to see a food lab use phrases like open source.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that was really a hope that was instilled in the place from the beginning. I think Renee, a lot of the questions that he was encountering, at least as far as he's told me, a lot of similar research they were doing in the early days of the restaurant, and realizing that, you know, the sort of immense range of varieties of wild plants and shellfish that are not even known about, let alone used in kitchens, was just so vast. And a lot of that knowledge used to be known, but has been forgotten. Other things like using seaweeds, for example, is very rich traditions in other parts of the world, but for whatever set of reasons in the Nordic region hasn't maybe existed so much. So there was a sense that there was all of this knowledge out there, very physically manifested knowledge, that should be investigated for the purpose of like expanding the flavors that are available, and that it wasn't enough to just sort of keep that proprietary just so Noma could use it, but that the best benefit would come by just putting it out into the world and seeing how it would be used and remixed in different ways.
Yeah, it's really interesting that the balance and the creative constraint of it, where it's global technique but local ingredients, mm-hmm. which means that you can apply the education anywhere, because you can take any of the global techniques but then apply it to your local regional ingredients, which I think is such a smart way that it can actually be exported, as opposed to, well, this is what we do with Norwegian cuisine, as opposed to you can now do this with Finnish cuisine or Mexican cuisine or Japanese cuisine.
Absolutely. And I think that's really on point. Most of the techniques, especially like when it comes to fermentation, for example, if you look at the Nordic Food Lab blog where we post a lot of the research, most of those techniques are not endemic to the Nordic region. They're from elsewhere. And what becomes interesting is seeing what happens when we do a kind of process of culinary translation, where we say, okay, how can we take this text, if you will, this script, and translate it into the sort of culinary lexicon of this region, and what happens to the flavors, what happens to the processes, what kind of new sensory experiences and culinary products can arise from that marriage of like this really, really ancient set of knowledge with a sort of ecological context that it hadn't been exposed to up until this point.
When did insects get introduced to the food lab?
As far as I know and have been told, it was slightly before my time. It probably started at the first MAD symposium in the summer of 2011. Alex Atala, this chef from Brazil, brought this this ant from the Amazon to share with everyone. He was giving a talk on relationships between plants and insects. And apparently it tasted very much of lemongrass or ginger or different things, depending on whom you ask. And Rene tasted it, and he was totally blown away, and he asked a question to Nordic Food Lab, which was, why can't I serve insects on my menu? For which he hired, he brought on Mark Emil Hermansen, a Dane who had studied anthropology, to sort of start to investigate the background to some of this question. Because it wasn't just a culinary question, right? It was also an historical one, an anthropological one, a cultural one. And so from there, I think the lab started to dabble in insects and to sort of say, okay, what species do we have around here that we might start to use? they started working with some local ants and some bee larvae. And then when I came on in June of 2012, shortly after graduating, the lab was just starting to put together a larger application for a grant to get funding to do like a proper 3-year research project, really going into it deeply. And one of the first things I started to do when I came was to help put together this grant application.
Were there any initial Western hangups of people eating insects, or because it was the Nordic Food Lab, everything was game and people were used to introducing new types of ingredients or unknown sources of protein or things to eat?
I think probably both, probably a bit of both. I mean, as our job was to taste everything. And so starting from that point, because that was kind of the microculture of Nordic Food Lab, we were always aware that that was part of our mandate in some ways. Some people who came, like especially some sort of short-term collaborators, sometimes it would take some people a little bit of time to warm up to the idea and to like get over this very, even though we were all, a lot of us around were eating them very easily, sometimes people who came in took a bit of time to get used to it, but yeah.
Post-grant, do you remember the first insect or dish that hit the NOMA standard or something that you felt, oh, this can actually be served and not just gimmick, but it actually is a really good dish. It just so happens that insects are the main ingredient.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I should start by saying that all of the techniques and the products that we sort of were working on at Nordic Food Lab were not necessarily for NOMA to take and put on their menu. They also, I mean, they have their own test kitchen where they develop dishes for themselves. That being said, we were definitely in constant dialogue. Probably one of the first really successful things that came out of the lab with insects was grasshopper garum, which is sort of this fermented umami sauce modeled partly after ancient Roman fish sauce, which is where the name garum comes from, and sort of also partly off of Southeast Asian fish sauces. And the idea was that you take something proteinous, add some salt and some fermented grain, and let it break down, and it becomes really, really savory. And instead of using fish guts, we would use grasshoppers or anything really, any sort of proteinous thing. And since then, we've also used like many other species of insect, and they all sort of have slightly distinct nuances from each other. But the first time that Nordic Food Lab did sort of really made a menu where we were developing fully conceived dishes with insects in sort of a gastronomic way was for an event that we did at the Wellcome Collection in London in spring of 2013. And that was sort of it was called Pestival. It was part of a festival that was about sort of human-insect relations in art and science. And so we were giving this lecture, and we developed a menu of, I think, 6 dishes and 3 beverages that sort of illustrated different approaches that we can take to using insects in a way, as you say, in a way that's not about novelty, it's not about gimmick value or shock value, it's really about trying to explore their huge range of tastes and textures in a sort of serious way, I guess.
We're going to take a quick musical break, and then we're going to be right back to talk to Josh Evans about the book on eating insects. You're listening to Snacky Tunes.
This is where a river starts. Though I know nothing could be perfect, there's places we pass through on our journey through the rapids, and then it takes a turn. There's some bits it goes to. Fresh water to salt. Now everyone controls you. Nothing could ever be stopped. back on me. This is where we had it all. Oh, after I implored you, oh, in this river, it's a ride, and it's hard to our lives. Or oh, we will be returned to the ocean. No, never thought it was far. Yeah, God, dude.
Before On Eating Insects came out, what was the literature on eating insects that was available in the world?
There is very little, I think. And that was one of the reasons why sort of the main motivation that we had for doing a project was really focused on the taste. Because at that point, sort of 2012, 2013, the conversation around edible insects in the world was rapidly becoming quite big. The FAO published this, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. They published this sort of landmark book on edible insects that was the most downloaded book by orders of magnitude in its entire history. So there was definitely a lot of interest, but there's really little work and sort of focus on what they actually tasted like. And rather than being an afterthought, it really seemed to us that if there's so much interest in getting more people to eat them and in sort of valorizing them as traditional foods, then we really have to know how to turn them into food for people who don't have them as a tradition. And so focusing on the taste and focusing on the culinary preparation was, like, rather than being a trivial thing, a really crucial part of the sort of larger argument. And what little there was, I don't even know if there was very much, was mostly in, like, an academic kind of place. And so we really saw a need and an opportunity to start doing research both in the lab and doing a lot of field work and sharing these stories about the diversity of flavors that were there and also some ways that we could make them appropriate to sort of Western cultures.
Right, and I think that's a good point. It's not like bugs were just discovered in 2010. They've been a huge part of other different cultures' diets for millennia. So how did you balance the approach of, you know, the West not just being like, look what we found, and folding in the history, the shared history of other cultures.
Absolutely. That was a huge focus of it and a really important point for me for the research throughout is that in many ways, Western cultures are the exception to the rule. For whatever set of reasons, they aren't very prominent here, whereas for many more cultures in the world, they are not just eaten, but are really delicacies. Foods that maybe have short seasons, but seasons that are looked forward to very much and aren't just eaten because people, you know, there's a common conception that like, oh yeah, of course, all of the poor tropical people eat insects because they're starving. It's like, couldn't be farther from the truth, actually.
Right. What's a good example of a dish that's a delicacy in a short growing season?
Well, let's see, like a lot of the, like termites, for example, in sub-Saharan Africa, there's loads of different species and different ways of preparing them. And they, like many insects in tropical and subtropical regions, are associated with the rainy season. So the onset of the rains is sort of the time when a lot of insects come. And the a lot of people across the, this region eat different kinds of termites. And they're something that they really look forward to. I mean, when we were doing fieldwork in Kenya and Uganda, and we would ask people that we were talking with or meeting around for different purposes, you know, if you could have a kilogram of beef or goat or termites, which would you have? And most people would say, oh, definitely take the termites. Yeah, so tasty.
What was the bug and what country that you found that was your favorite?
This is a very hard question. It's a very common question. and I always find myself giving different answers depending on my mood and what stories I remember. I think there's a few. Talking about termites, I mean, the termite queen is an exceptional food.
And just what's the taste?
She's firstly, we should say, she's much, much larger than any termite. She's about, I mean, maybe her abdomen alone is like 8 centimeters. And it's this fat, plump, like liquidy. In the film that we made, Ben, my former colleague, describes it as God's handmade sausage, which I think is a pretty apt description. And it has this amazing sort of nutty aroma and while it's cooking, and it sort of firms up when you cook it on like a pan on the fire. And then the texture is really like soft and spongy, sort of like sweetbreads. And it has this sort of sweetbread, somewhat foie gras, sort of nutty organ meat kind of deliciousness.
Sounds incredible.
It is. There's nothing like nothing I've ever tasted.
That sounds amazing. So before we get into the recipes in the book, I think what's really interesting is the essays that you have in here about the political implications, the geographical implications, sustainability implications. How did you approach that, and who did you approach to write the essays? Because it's not just you that wrote the book. There's many authors who share the title.
Yes. So when we started the project, I think, and probably the reason we got the funding in the first place is because we were drawing on and reproducing essentially the same kind of story that was being told at the time. Like, there's a huge food crisis, it's primarily about food production, and insects are poised to like save this and be this kind of silver bullet. And then over the course of doing the project, doing the field work, reading into it more, developing more critical questions, it became clear that things were a lot more complicated than that. And that sort of is where a lot of these essays emerged from. I think at least a few of the essays in the book are kind of condensed and revised from a couple academic papers that we wrote about some of these political sustainability questions around how unpredictable food systems are and how, in many cases, it's a lot more about sort of power and access and inequality than it is about how much food we produce as like a crude commodity.
Can you talk about the power aspect of it?
Yeah, so I mean, often when we talk about this, I think it's really useful to look at historical precedents for similar kinds of things. So if we look at soybeans, for example, earlier in the 20th century, in like the 30s, 40s, and 50s, a lot of people were identifying soybeans as this thing that was just going to solve everything and totally eliminate hunger, as this like cheap, plant-based, protein-rich thing that had this huge body of traditional knowledge associated with it, a lot of genetic diversity, a lot of sort of existing culinary applications, and that if everyone just ate more soy, that it would kind of fix everything. But of course, that's not how things have panned out at all. And what's much more the case is that vast monocultures of GM soy that's owned privately the sort of seeds and genome of which are owned privately are being planted in the Amazon and leading to the deforestation of the continent, and so and then being shipped as a commodity to North America and Europe so that we can raise cheap cattle and continue to eat beef in a very bad way.
So do you think we'll see GMO crickets or caterpillars sometime down the line?
It's possible. Definitely, and that was something that emerged from like going to some of these really big international conferences around eating insects, that you had people who were doing fascinating, fantastic work on like ethnobiology and working with like trying to document this huge range of knowledge associated with these ecologies. But then you also had like the Cargos and the Nestles who were sort of figuring out how they could turn this into money. And that wasn't just something that we were like speculating on. That was something that like we explicitly encountered from people. And so that, you know, that's why it's, I think it's too simplistic to say insects are good or insects are bad. Like many things, it's actually a lot less about the organism itself, and it's a lot more about this, the systems that humans build around them that determines what kind of positive or sustainable impact they have.
The book is stunning. The photos are incredible. I think that if you were to get a book on eating insects, you could think that there might be some close-ups of some larvae or some close-up of just some things. And the photos just look like any high-end, beautiful book. So what was the approach to the recipes, and how easy is it for someone at home, a home cook, to make some of these dishes?
Yeah, I think you're really right to pick up on this kind of visual aspect of the book. And we at Nordic Food Lab, and also the folks at Fiden, we were really on the same page about this from the beginning, that we didn't want to make a book that was like, oh, like, let's, you know, make a pizza and throw some mealworms on it and, like, call it a day. It's like, that's not sort of what we're about, both from the gastronomic angle and also from the visual angle of having, I mean, especially Fiden is so, they have so much focus on, like, really investing in the visual aspect of their books, which was really great. And also from our point of view, I mean, sometimes it would make sense to, you know, change the form of the insect so that we can introduce people to the taste without necessarily forcing them to confront that kind of psychological barrier of saying, I'm eating a whole larva. But then other times, there are other dishes in the book where we're really celebrating the whole form of that insect. And maybe those are sort of a bit more advanced in some way for eaters, where they're for people who already are developing this relationship with them as foods and can say, okay, I'm ready to kind of encounter it as a food. I'm ready to have that, you know, that fish head or that that thing that reminds me of the whole animal. And I think both approaches, having this range of approaches, is really important when we're sort of introducing new foods.
You also talk about cultivating your own insects. So for early beginner, first time out insect eater, how do you recommend people getting the insects to start eating or testing or cooking with?
I think it's in a lot of ways, it's like kind of the same story that we might want to talk about for any kind of food, whether it's vegetables or meat or anything. It's like start local, like start with what's around you. Of course, for many of us, there aren't like existing insect industries, which is why I think one place I really like to start with are with bee larvae, and with like that's often a byproduct that you can find from local beekeepers, because many beekeepers more and more are practicing this sort of technique of removing some bee larvae as a way of reducing this varroa mite, this parasite in the hive. And then they have it as a byproduct, and often they'll just throw it away. And instead, you can sort of use it and start experimenting with it.
I wonder if you can go to your local pet store and just get crickets like you would feed to your animals as well.
Yeah, and that's something that we started out with, especially in the beginning of the project, where we would get insects to work with that were, you know, of food grade quality, but they were produced primarily with the intention of being bought by like pet keepers who had reptiles, for example, who like needed to serve them live prey. But we ended up finding some producers in Germany and the Netherlands and things that really were producing some, you know, they were producing edible things, feeding them like actual plant matter, and we could work with them. Yeah.
I would be remiss to not ask, was there any bug or dish that just no matter how hard you tried, just couldn't get past the point of I'm eating bugs and this is not working?
Yes, definitely. Well, there are two sort of angles to this. One is like on field work, when we would you know, not everything we taste in a fieldwork was like amazingly revelatory.
Not everything was God sausage.
No, not everything was God sausage. So there's that angle, and that's fine. I mean, also that's very cultural too. I mean, a lot of like cheese for many people is also totally disgusting. It's basically like rotten milk. I totally get that. And then when we were in the lab, yeah, I mean, even what was interesting also is like even within the same species, we ended up tasting quite a range of things within the same species, like depending on how they were fed and reared. So like getting crickets that were actually quite tasty versus getting crickets that tasted like fish meal because they had been fed fish meal, you know, like that's kind of a no-brainer, but it should be said that that's very much a thing, like with any kind of animal. There's a range of flavors that have to do with like how humans are intervening in their livelihood and in their life cycle. Also processing, like a lot of insects nowadays are like freeze-dried to be given like somewhat stable shelf life and to be able to be shipped a lot around the world. But a lot of insects are very fatty. They have a lot of unsaturated fats, especially, and those fats go rancid really quickly. And then they ended up tasting sort of like rancid cardboard. And like, that's not very tasty, you know? And that's sort of a similar logic in many ways to growing a tomato that's bred to like be really hard and shippable, rather than a tomato that isn't going to make it very far, but it's going to be really, really delicious and really, really nourishing for you. And I think the same holds true for anything, really.
You're thinking about the sun golds.
I'm thinking about the sun golds. And I want, you know, whether it's an insect or a tomato or a vegetable or any kind of food, I think that is what excites me about eating. And that kind of, that pursuit of that experience, I think also has a really transformative potential for food systems. That the more that we can focus on and attend to the potential of giving that sun gold kind of experience to more people, the better our food systems will look like, the better they'll be.
Well, Josh, I want to thank you for coming on to Snacky Tunes. Where can people get the book, find your work, follow you on Twitter?
Yeah, I think the book is coming out May 1st, which is very exciting. It should be available, as they say, anywhere where books are sold. I don't know. It should be, and also online, of course. And yeah, I'm on Twitter, Josh D. Evans, I believe.
Great. We're going to take another quick musical break, and we will be back with the second part of Snacky Tunes.
Yeah.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a national nonprofit network with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Chefs Collaborative members work to make sustainable practices second nature for every chef in the United States. Chefs Collaborative was founded in 1993 by visionary chefs including Rick Bayless and Alice Waters, who acknowledged the influential role of food professionals on our food choices, our collective personal health, the vitality of cultures, and the integrity of the global environment. Chefs Collaborative believes that the greater culinary community can be a catalyst for positive change by expanding the market for good food and helping to preserve local farming and fishing communities. Change menus, change lives. Learn more about Chefs Collaborative at chefscollaborative.org.
Welcome back. We're live here on Snacky Tunes with Hey Baby. Welcome to the show. Good to see the three of you.
Thank you.
Do you want to go around the room and introduce yourselves?
Hi, I'm Jeremy.
I'm Sam.
Hi, I'm Leslie.
Hello.
Hello.
Nice to see all of you. You guys started playing together as a band in 2011, but didn't put out the first full length until 2015. You talked about having to find the right sound and formation. What kind of led to that, and when did you feel you were ready to write that first record?
Well, I don't know. All of us came from listening to and playing very different kinds of music, so I feel like we spent a long time
finding a middle ground.
Yeah, and finding out how all that interlocked, you know, into something coherent.
What's a good example of two bands that were on the opposite ends of the spectrum that you had to kind of work towards as reference points?
Well, for example, I enjoy sad guy guitar music, you know, which Leslie doesn't really. And
boo-hoo.
Jeremy enjoys very, very angry music.
Yeah, I like metal. Yeah.
Metal. What's a good example of sad guy guitar music?
You know, like Nick Drake.
Okay, yeah.
That kind of thing. Stephen Stevens.
And Leslie, what are you into? Or where?
100% Kraftwerk.
Okay. So Kraftwerk, Nick Drake, and metal all had to find a
common ground. You roll that all together, you get our band.
How do you begin on that process? I think the best thing about bands is that it's generally a group of people with totally different backgrounds all coming together to make something that they wouldn't do on their own. So where did you find compromise, overlap, and what were some things that were non-negotiable?
Well, I don't think we went into this band with the idea that we were going to craft a specific sound.
Right.
And all of, like, 90% of our songs are born from just jamming together. So in doing that, you kind of, like, you know, dance around what the core of the song is, and then you get to it together. And when you do, it's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
but the reason it took so long, I think I hadn't even thought of a band as like a recorded product for years. Like, we were just like having so much fun playing live and trying to like craft our live shows into like I remember, God, a first show at Don Pedro or something. I was like, why did that sound so bad? So like, we were trying to figure out how to make it sound good when you're playing in front of people, and then few years got away.
Yeah, I mean, I that's a good point, actually. I mean, and for us, you know, we hadn't really been, or I at least hadn't really been in a band that sounded good live before, and so that was also exciting to explore that and realize you could have, you know, and then when you play a good live show, I feel like it's this kind of ecstatic experience, you know, where you have like this, you know, this communion between yourself and the audience, and that's a special experience that doesn't exist in a recording, really, or any other context.
Right, the energy is just almost, it's just so engaging.
Yeah.
It's almost like a drug,
yeah,
in a way. So it's hard to take a break from that and then be like, now we're going to go away and sit in a studio and make a record.
I do think it took us a while to really hone in on that.
And did the sound evolve from the early shows into what ended up on Sleepy Kids?
I feel like these two have a much different musical experience than me, because mm-hmm. I kind of joined late in the game. I had already played with a few other bands, like mm-hmm. Airwaves and Motel Motel, and kind of had done the whole touring and musician.
Also, like a third of that album was written before Jeremy was in the band.
Yeah.
So we finished it with him.
Yeah.
But.
But yeah, all those songs developed out of, well, not all of them actually. A lot of those songs developed out of, you know, years of playing live, and then a few of them were we wrote closer to the to when we recorded it, right?
Yeah.
Could we hear a song?
Sure.
Yeah.
What are you going to play for us first?
This is a song called Home off our upcoming full-length.
Yet to be titled.
Uncertain title.
Uncertain title. Yeah. Which is not the title, it's just uncertain title.
Well,
but we're not ruling that out either.
Okay. Yeah.
Should we tell you what we're thinking about?
Sure. Or play the song and we can talk about it afterwards.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Here we go. Hey Baby, live on Snacky Tunes.
Oops. 1, 2, 3, 4. There's no going home. You are on your own. Everybody's gone. Moved on.
When you put out the Blood Honest EP last spring, you talked about the songwriting and the ideas about it being around the concept of how difficult it was to exist as a human being. Do you find that it's still difficult to exist as a human being May 2017, 100%. A year later?
Always.
What are some of the daily difficulties of being blood and flesh?
Drinking water.
Well, first of all, you have to keep your body literally alive, which is a total hassle. And then being aware of any single thing that's happening in the world is, 90% of the time a bummer.
What's the 10% of the time when it's not a bummer?
You're playing music on stage.
Yeah. Yeah, right. No, sometimes there's good news.
And there's definitely times you're like, oh, man, today's going to be a great day, and you go outside, and it's beautiful out, and birds are chirping, and then you step in a big puddle, or someone honks at you and tells you to walk faster, you jerk, but in much more coarse language.
I mean, obviously, like, this is a particularly galling time to read the news, you know, but I guess it's always a galling time to read the news, you know.
This one feels particularly heavy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I really like the point where you lay down or sit down after being not sitting down all day. That's the 10% that's pretty good.
Right.
Yeah.
That and while you're eating, but not right after you've eaten.
I don't know. Chewing?
Really? Is that one of the... I mean, that's a big hassle that you have to do with every day.
Oh,
chewing.
My God.
Would you rather just go after something like a Soylent? Just, like, drinking nutrients?
I don't know. I just wish my teeth were, like, better, like, pointier or something.
That would make it harder to chew, I feel, if all your teeth were really pointy.
I don't know.
You know, you need good grinders.
I mean, I enjoy the flavors of food, but it's mostly just, like, my dad was like, you gotta chew 40 times before you swallow.
Oh, I think that's probably, I think we just got to the root of the problem. It's less about chewing and more the fact that you have a number of 40 in your head every time. But every time I took a bite, I had to think, 40 times for every bite, I would hate chewing as well.
I don't think I'm quite that obsessive compulsive, but it is something that I think about.
We'll teach you some tricks after the show how to chew your food in like half the time.
Right. Cool, thanks.
Yeah, we're in a restaurant. We'll just go around the room and get some tips from the audience out there.
You look like you're good at eating.
Yeah, you look like you're good, but you don't do that much chewing. What's your secret?
Slurp.
Yeah.
Oh, could you? I don't know if there's any pizza slurpers out here, but if there was one, we could probably find them.
Yeah,
do you guys cook for each other, or do you make food for each other? Any communal?
Leslie kind of cooks for us sometimes.
Yeah.
Well, she does a great job too.
Yeah.
What do you normally cook?
Normally, well, I'm Korean, so my hand in the kitchen leans Korean.
Okay.
I make a lot of noodle soups, soft tofu stews. I've been working on this shrimp dish that I hope to have at our future imaginary restaurant.
Oh, wait, you guys going to open a restaurant?
That's the dream.
Is it going to be Korean food?
Probably, like, a mixed bag. I'm thinking, like, bowls. Like, customizable, mostly vegetarian bowls with, like, add some meat protein options. Sandwiches, rotating specials, stuff. Yeah.
I'm into this. I mean, I know you haven't named the album yet, but does the restaurant have a name?
No.
No?
It's still pretty imaginary.
Still very far from the future.
I've always wanted to name a restaurant Scallion, but I think it's as equally stupid as it is bougie.
Scallion.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to really, you know, everything else would have to be just right for you to get away with it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can we hear another song?
Sure.
What are you going to play for us?
This is another one off the next unnamed album. It's called Animosity.
Hey, baby, why can't
All right. Elephant in the room, that new record. Let's talk about it. So, no title? Possible title?
We've had a couple ideas.
Okay. Let's put them all out here, so when it comes out, we can use it as a reference point what it could have been.
Well, the first thought that we had was to call it I Am Not Stopped, which is a quote from, I think, Bill Cosby's confession.
Yeah. When he gave a deposition back in the day, and he described molesting someone, basically.
Like a sleeping person.
Yeah.
That he
and
drugged.
So he's telling this story in, you know, first person present. He's saying, you know, I do this, I do that, you know, I reach over, you know, I touch her, I am not stopped, you know. And it's just a chilling thing to read him saying, and just seems very emblematic of that.
The difficulty of being a human in 2017.
Yeah.
All right, I'm not stopped. That's good. What's up? What's another one?
You can talk about it.
Oh, well, another one was They Get There, which is one of our very first internets was some Portuguese blog wrote about us in Portuguese, and none of us speak Portuguese, so we Google translated it, and the title of the piece was "They Get There."
That's so good.
Right?
That's really good. That's actually I'm gonna just put my hat towards the other one, of a less darker but still very funny, and it's also coming out on Tiny Engines, correct?
Yeah, that's the plan.
Which is your home for the last couple projects?
Yeah, they've been great.
Rad people.
Absolutely.
Yeah, super supportive. Yeah. They're just like two dudes who love music and have been doing it like hard and well for years. Just the two of them for a while, I guess. Maybe there are more people involved, but we don't talk to anybody else.
Well, they've got some interns.
Yeah.
Just a couple of interns rotating.
Yeah.
I mean, it's always good to find a home that gets you, and also your label mates. You're the bands that are you know, that you keep in good company.
Oh yeah,
good company.
Yeah. We've met so many like beautiful people. Mm-hmm. Like everyone else on the label is like pretty much sweethearts, and like for some reason we just keep like a national tour community going with them. So it's pretty sweet.
And you have some upcoming shows with them, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, one of our label mates, See Through Dresses, is coming through from Omaha on June 24th, and we'll be playing with them.
And then there's another one too, right? Sunnyvale.
June 24th, we're playing with See Through Dresses at
Bar on Kia, which is like a DIY house show spot, like and deep into Bushwick.
And then on July 15th, we're playing another show. But that actually, I think the venue is still
TBD. Might be at our house.
Might be.
At,
yeah. It'll be somewhere.
Yeah.
Do you do house shows?
We do sometimes.
Okay.
Yeah. It's called the Hey Baby Cat Farm.
How many cats are there?
Well, they're actually dwindling.
Yeah.
Not for any macabre reason.
Sure.
We haven't been harvesting them.
Yeah.
Okay.
But there were three at maximum cat.
Yeah.
And now, cat,
wait, maximum capacity?
Capacity?
Oh, yes.
Capacity. That's exactly right. Yes. That's correct.
Yeah, but I'm moving to Richmond and taking two of them with me.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay. We want to make sure we have time for one more song, but where can people find you, hear the old records, get the new title at release, get the new record?
Spotify?
You can just Google Hey Baby, I think. HAYBABY.
All one word.
All one word.
Cool. Well, we want to thank Josh Evans for coming on earlier to talk about Uneating Insects, which is out now on Fade and Books. Make sure to grab it at their website or over at Amazon or wherever you get books. Hey, baby, thanks for joining us. We will be back next week with an all-new episode of Snacky Tunes. What is the name of the last song you're going to play for us?
Get Down.
Oh, perfect. Well, let's get there. Thanks for coming on. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.
Talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.